Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, out of the office today, so no updates of the commodity markets. However, we have a really interesting program that's focused on biodiesel. I spoke with Scott Irwin not long after U.S. EPA released on November the 30th most recent volumes for the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standards. I have Scott's reaction, which you haven't heard directly, and some of his thoughts about biodiesel. And it all comes up in this edition of the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Let me take a moment as we get started for this day to remind you about some of our online programming and how you may use it over time. As you know, since 2003, University of Illinois and WILL have been posting Commodity Week as a podcast. It may be one of the very oldest podcasts on the planet. We're very proud of that. You can always pick it up and all the rest of our programming online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can look in the podcast section, or if you prefer and you just happen to use iTunes, search for either Closing Market Report or Commodity Week. You may be even able to search for my name, Todd Gleason, and you'll find the podcast there. You can listen to these programs online on your computer, on your phone, whether it's an Android and or a iPhone or other device that can connect to the internet of any type, including your iPad and other kinds of pads. So make sure you visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. All of our agricultural programming is posted to the content sections there not long after it airs on our radio stations. It's just part of the service that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. We've been putting this program together in its current iteration since 1985. It's all about farm broadcasting, commodities, and commodity prices, along with weather. So pick it up right there at willag.org. Again, the web address, willag.org. Do it right now. Do it online. Do it on your own convenience. For this 1 week, we'll add a regular feature to the Closing Market Report. We call it Trading Terms. Our term for the day is futures contract, or just futures. It is a standardized contract between two parties to buy or sell a specified asset of a standardized quantity and or quality for a price agreed upon today, the futures price, with delivery and payment occurring at a specified future date, the delivery date. The contracts are negotiated at a futures exchange, which acts as an intermediary between the two parties. The party agreeing to buy the underlying asset in the future, the buyer of the contract, is said to be long, and the party agreeing to sell the asset in the future, the seller of the contract, is said to be short. While the futures contract specifies a trade taking place in the future, the purpose of the futures exchange institution is to act as the intermediary and minimize the risk of default by either party. Thus, the exchange requires both parties to put up an initial amount of cash, the margin. Additionally, since the futures price will generally change daily, the difference in the prior agreed-upon price and daily futures price is settled daily also. That's called variation margin. The exchange will draw money out of one party's margin account and put it into the other so that each party has the appropriate daily loss or profit. If the margin account goes below a certain value, then a margin call is made, and the account owner must replenish the margin account. By the way, the Chicago Board of Trade listed the first ever standardized exchange-traded forward contracts in 1864, which were called futures contracts. This contract was based on grain trading and started a trend that saw contracts created on a number of different commodities, as well as a number of futures exchanges set up around the world. And that's the definition of futures contract.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson. Since 1985, Stewart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stewart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today, so no update of the commodity markets. However, we will take a look at the United States Environmental Protection Agency's RFS rulemaking that happened in November of 2015. The day that these numbers were released, I asked Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the U of I, to come downstairs from his third floor office to my office in the basement of Bumford Hall to discuss them and to talk about what the impact might be on agriculture.
Well, I think they were very interesting. They were quite close to my expectations. The ethanol came in for 2014 at 13.61 billion gallons, which I think was widely expected, technical adjustment. But what apparently surprised many was how aggressive the EPA was in adjusting upward the 2015 and 2016 ethanol mandates. 2015 went up to 14.05 billion gallons and 2016 all the way up to 14.5 billion gallons.
What have been the challenges of trying to reach the 15 billion gallon goal for conventional or corn-based ethanol?
Everything has revolved around the E10 blend wall, which means that, you know, there's 10% ethanol in the vast majority of the gasoline offered in the United States. And the standards, if you go up to 15 billion gallons, for example, that would be more ethanol than we can consume in the form of E10. And that's where the rub has been in terms of, should we move forward and, in essence, force breaching of the E10 blend wall or not?
Do you believe EPA is on the path to reach that 15 billion gallon goal at some point?
Yes, I do. Administrators have made a number of statements indicating that they want to, quote, get the RFS back on track. And after, you know, reading through the proposal yesterday and the kind of arguments that the EPA made in that proposal, the final rulemaking, I wouldn't be surprised if they went back to the 15 billion gallons in 2017, again, if market conditions seem favorable for that when they make the proposal next year.
Cellulosic ethanol was written into the original RFS legislation. It remains a bleeding-edge product line. How has EPA addressed it?
There's certainly lots of words in the rulemaking document expressing support for the potential for cellulosic ethanol, but the volumes that are projected and then built into the cellulosic mandates are still minuscule. We're talking about in 2015, 4 million gallons of liquid cellulosic ethanol. And if you, the totals that are listed for the cellulosic mandates are in some ways a little misleading, because about 90% of the cellulosic volumes that are reported are actually for biogas, not for what we'd call conventional liquid cellulosic ethanol.
Is the biodiesel industry a winner this time around?
Absolutely. Biodiesel and renewable diesel, which both come under the heading of the biomass-based diesel category, definitely are in the catbird seat moving forward, at least for the next year or two. The big battle that's shaping up is for those gallons that are above the E10 blend wall, will those be met with higher ethanol blends or biodiesel and renewable diesel? I think the EPA certainly came down on the side that in the short run it will be biodiesel and renewable diesel, and I agree with that. But as we look down the road, that's where we're going to see in a year, maybe two, as long as 3 years down the road, E85 could, with some time, become much more competitive and put a cap on some of the expansion of biodiesel. But until we get to that point, it looks like smooth sailing for that industry.
What, if anything, does US EPA rulemaking on the RFS say about the clout of agriculture in Washington, D.C.?
My own personal view is that the history of the political battle over the RFS, where we are today, shows the continuing power and muscle of the ag lobby in Washington, D.C. The way I would, I think, best illustrate that, Jeff, is if we go all the way back to 2 years ago when the EPA first made their original proposal for 2014, basically that proposal said, we're just going to cut off the ethanol mandates at whatever the E10 blend wall is, and we just don't see much on the horizon reason to try to breach that to any significant degree. And if you projected that framework out through the current end of the RFS in 2022, you would get something around a 17 billion gallon total cut in the ethanol mandate between 2014 and 2022. Fast forward to today and the rulemaking that was released yesterday, the what I think are the projected total cuts now are just a little over 2.2 billion gallons. I mean, that's a huge swing in fortunes in 2 years for the ag and biofuels sector.
Scott, you've told us biodiesel is a big winner in this round of the RFS and said many times that if EPA reaches for the conventional mandate of 15 billion gallons of ethanol usage, the gap between that and the 10% blend wall, or about 13.2 to 13.4 billion gallons roughly, will need to be filled. What's the easy answer to which product fills this gap?
At least for the next couple of years, biodiesel. I mean, just look at a soybean oil chart. Soybean oil prices since the low last August are up 25%. And soybean prices are up 3%. And meal is tanked over that same time period. So, you know, this is going to have, you know, one way or another, it's beneficial to ag. Either I'm wrong and you get more ethanol in the form of E85, or you get more biodiesel with soybean oil and other animal fats.
Can we get ethanol in the form of sorghum?
Sorghum is mainly used as an alternative feedstock for conventional ethanol production. There's one plant I know for sure, and maybe two, but one for sure
in Kansas
that apparently has had a great deal of trouble with getting the whole system to work, producing using sorghum and producing an ethanol that qualifies for an advanced RIN. To do that, they have to have cogeneration of the electricity, but more importantly, the heat that dries the DDGs. It's obviously not easy to do, or all the other plants would be doing it.
Tell me about biodiesel production capacity in the United States.
Biodiesel production capacity, according to the EIA, is about 2.7 billion gallons. And that's capacity that is registered with the EPA to produce D4 biomass-based diesel RINs. The National Biodiesel Board shows that there's, I think, as much as 600 million gallons of mothballed biodiesel production around the U.S. that's not yet registered to produce RINs for RFS compliance, but presumably could be in a fairly straightforward manner. So someplace between 2.7 and 3.3 billion gallons is the best estimate.
The conversion rate for corn ethanol is 2.8 gallons per bushel. Do you know the conversion rate for soybeans to biodiesel?
I'd have to think about it. Well, let's see. Each bushel of soybeans produces about 11 pounds of oil, and it takes about 7.5 pounds of soybean oil to make a gallon of biodiesel. So you're getting
not quite two,
probably about 1.75 gallons of biodiesel per bushel.
And it takes a lot of bushels then.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think, well, I the soybean oil market has clearly figured this out. You know, a big part of this depends on how quickly or if at all E85 expansion could occur, because we now know the kind of parameters that are in front of us is that there is going to very quickly be a size of the gaps above the E10 blend wall that's going to require a lot of either E85 biodiesel or both. And if it's just biodiesel, I think people are just kind of beginning to get their heads around just how much biodiesel we are likely to need in the next 2 or 3 years. Looks to me like if you look at the advanced component plus the potential for the filling the gap above the E10 blend wall, that it's difficult for me to see how we need any less than 2.5 billion gallons of biodiesel either produced or imported. And again, when I say biodiesel, that could be either conventional biodiesel or renewable diesel. They're interchangeable, basically, as far as the RFS is concerned. And we have been importing a lot of renewable diesel lately. And we have a couple big renewable diesel plants in the U.S. as well. I think we're could say that yesterday marked the official start of what I see as a major biodiesel boom.
So this is good news. However, well, if you're a corn producer and ethanol producer, one of the two. However, it's still below the 15 billion gallon
correct.
Mandate.
That's
statute.
Correct. That whole controversy is going to continue in the courts. I don't know how soon the cases will be litigated, but I would presume it will be soon. But what's fascinating to me of what they've done, knowing that they're on the verge of going to court, is they've pretty much minimized the total cuts over 14, 15, and 16. And I think that they are providing a loud and clear signal that they intend in 17 to get back to the statutory level.
In hopes of not having to go to court, probably.
Well, or somehow that bolstering their case in the court. I don't know. But staying on ethanol, okay. I want to make what I think. There's a lot of numbers here, and you know it's easy to get confused with all these numbers. But the bottom line is, in May, in their preliminary proposal, I argued that the EPA was telegraphing their pass. They were telegraphing that they were going to move forward fairly aggressively to get the ethanol mandate back to the statutory level. And if you took them at their word, this is, I think, very consistent with it, with that message which was telegraphed in the preliminary proposal. But I've had too many conversations to count since May when people didn't believe what the EPA and the EPA Administrator McCarthy was saying about their intent to get things back on track. They now only have to go up another 500 million gallons in 2017 on the ethanol mandate to get back to statutory levels.
And given all of that, it's probably important to remember the statutory levels are actually above the 10% blend rate.
Correct.
So there's two things at work here. There's something where Congress said you can use, we want you to use 15 million gallons, and let's use corn-based ethanol, right?
Right?
We want you to use 15 million gallons of corn-based ethanol in 2015. But by the way, no more than 10% of the total supply. And at first, when they put these in place, they thought that 15 million gallons would be probably less than what we would use. And this was in 2007, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Would be used in 2015. As it turns out, the CAFE standards changed, and we got more efficient in gasoline usage, and the 10% is actually below the 15 billion gallon statute.
That is correct.
But it looks like they're on target at 17 to get back to what the statute says, so 15 billion gallons, because it's for corn going forward at this point.
And you know, that doesn't honestly surprise me, because I think, like I said, the EPA was telegraphing this message to the markets last May, that they had done a major about face as a result, I think, of the pressure coming out of the ag and biofuels sectors and their political muscle is on full display here, because we went from a situation in late 2013 with the EPA, you know, that first proposal for 2014 basically said, looking forward, we're going to put a ceiling on the ethanol mandate right at the E10 blend wall. At that point, it was 13 billion gallons, and so they would push it up only as that blend wall volume went up. My calculations are that would, you could have, at that time, based on the information you had in late 2013, you would have projected that would have totaled between 14 and 2022 about 17 billion gallons of cuts in the RFS.
We've been talking with University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin about the RFS, the renewable fuels standards, as they were released by EPA on the 30th day of November. You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. If you'd like to learn more about the RFS, RINs, biodiesel, ethanol, and cellulosic ethanol, you can always do that on the Farm Doc Daily website. There are many articles that are penned by not only Scott Irwin, but Daryl Good and others from the U of I's Ag Econ family, up on the website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Again, that's farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. On vacation this week, so we're running through some of the interviews I've done in the last month or so for you in greater detail to give you an insight into what the agricultural economists, some of the other folks that I talked to, have been thinking about. You can find those all up online at our website, again, at willag.org. When we come back, we'll take a look at El Nino. Eric Snodgrass will be here from Agribull.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
It's Eat Vegetarian Day. It's also National Chocolate Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1763, John Molson was born. He was the founder of Molson Brewery in Montreal, Canada. In 1814, John Bennett Laws was born, an English agronomist. He initiated the artificial fertilizer industry, and he was the founder of the world's first agricultural research station. In 1842, he patented a method to make superphosphate by treating phosphate rock with sulfuric acid. 1 year later, he partnered with Joseph Gilbert to establish an agricultural research station where they studied animal nutrition as well as the effects of inorganic and organic fertilizers on crop yields. In 1869, William Finley Semple patented the first chewing gum made of, quote, the combination of rubber with other articles. But he never commercially manufactured the gum. That honor went to Thomas Adams. And in 1886, Josephine Cochran patented the first commercially successful dishwashing machine. She marketed the machine to hotels and restaurants, and the machine was a huge hit at the 1893 Columbian Exposition. Her company eventually evolved into KitchenAid. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This Stock and Commodity Report is made possible with support from Bates Commodities and Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass. He's at Agrible right here in town. You can find them online, by the way, at agrible.com. He's been looking into next summer and thinking about how El Nino, which has been bringing a lot of rainfall to many places across the planet, will transition to La Nina and what that might mean for the Midwest. I take it you've been delving into the historical accounts of the really strong El Ninos and what happens in the following seasons?
Yeah, that's exactly what we've been doing. And it's interesting, you know, El Ninos, as they transition out of the, you know, out of that phase, the warm phase across the Pacific and into the cooler phase called La Nina, statistically don't have any really strong correlations with either heat or with lack of rain or excessive rain across the Corn Belt. So it kind of seems like when either El Nino's going strong or La Nina's going strong is when we have our most definable characteristics for our growing season next year. So what we're forecasting now, though, is that the current El Nino, which is very strong, could possibly be the strongest on record. It's got a couple of years to be here. That's the 82-83 event and the 97-98 event. But it's pretty strong, and it kind of wanes here, spring and early summer, maybe getting back toward what we would call neutral conditions across the Pacific. You know, that would be the same time period that we're planting next season's crops and getting into, pollination and harvest. And then we're really looking forward to seeing what happens at the end of the growing season if we transition into La Nina conditions. That could mean a big change for our winter and could also mean a big change for what happens in Brazil next winter.
And what are those conditions look like?
Yeah, I'd say that the stronger signal is to look toward the southern hemisphere in Brazil. That basically means that they tend to go into more drought-like conditions. And think back in 2011, that was the last time we had a good strong La Nina event. I don't know if you remember, but the prices of beans were trading, you know, up in the teens, and it was because the Brazilian crop wasn't coming in because of really dry, hot conditions. So while this year, 2015, is looking great because of El Nino for them, you know, there could be some adversity in their crop conditions in the next winter due to La Nina. You know, back here in the States, big thing for us is usually when we have a La Nina that settles in a winter, we tend to be a little colder. In the northern parts of the U.S. and parts of the Corn Belt. It's not a perfect correlation there, but that's, you know, statistically significant. We do see that.
Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible from right here in Champaign County. You may find them online at agrible.com. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Our address on the web is willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.